Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our guest is Margaret Dartness. She has a wonderful book called Brutal Silence. But before she was a published author, she was everything. She's a corporate lawyer and a university administrator, corporate executive, working and living and studying all over the world. But she got interested in human trafficking, and that led her to write. That was one of the things that got her interested in writing this book, which is set in the context of brutal human trafficking. It's called Brutal Silence, but mainly it's a mystery. It's a, what do you call it? Thriller.
Thriller, yes.
Thriller. Welcome, Margaret. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Gigi.
Just why did you write this book?
Well, over 10 years ago, I went to a conference at UNC. A friend urged me to come, and she said, it's about human trafficking. I said, I don't know anything about that. And she said, well, that's the reason you should come. And Linnea Smith, who's Dean Smith's wife and a real advocate for women, talked UNC into having this conference. And people came from all over the world to speak at it. It's a very impressive group. In fact, they had two of those. At lunchtime, I sat next to a woman who had been trafficked and who was speaking out in hopes of saving others from her experience. Her story was a pretty common one. She was from El Salvador, an educated woman. She came to the United States on the promise of a job and found herself imprisoned in an apartment in Brooklyn for 3 years. And she managed to escape. She's now a U.S. citizen and has two children and has been interviewed by the New York Times. And I was very impressed with her, but I was horrified by her story.
What was it? What about what? How did she get trapped into this situation?
Well, she came with hopes of finding a job and found, as is very common, found that there was no job. It was she became a trafficked.
She had a job lined up.
That's
she
right.
Thought she did.
She thought she did, but she became a victim of trafficking and was locked in this apartment for 3 years. And one of her
and was this for prostitution?
Was yes, this was prostitution.
This is where the money is.
That's
the,
right. That's right. And one of her Johns helped her to escape. And I was so moved by her story and so impressed by her that I wanted to find out more about human trafficking.
So, let me just how could you stay? Anybody keep you confined for 3 years in one room, and as if in prison or enslavement in modern day America?
Well, often trafficked people are controlled by their traffickers. They have their papers taken away from them if they're here legally. They're not let out of the sights of the traffickers. And then often they become victims of the Stockholm syndrome. They are afraid.
They become
right. Emotionally
a part of the family
trapped.
Of the exploiters.
Yes, right, right. So I don't know that she never got out of this room, but she spent most of her time in this small apartment in Brooklyn. But anyway, I then set out to try to find out more about human trafficking. And 15 years ago, there was very little to find on it. It was almost a veil of silence. People didn't want to talk about it, didn't want to write about it or read about it. But I found everything I could. And there were activists who were starting to speak out and people who were starting to listen. I've always wanted to write a thriller. In my corporate existence or in academia, most of what I wrote was fairly turgid, dry, dull stuff. And so I'd come home at night and I'd read thrillers because it was a nice contrast.
Can you remember the authors? Or the
I like Elmore Leonard. I like Sarah Paretsky. I like a whole variety of thriller writers.
And just to take to bed with you and read to sleep or to keep you awake instead of...
Well, I like thrillers and mysteries. And I'm not a violent person, so I often wondered why I liked them. But I think the reason is that they pose a problem in almost every case. And at the end, they solve it. There's a resolution. And, in life, it doesn't work that way.
It stretches out.
So,
right.
So it's actually kind of relaxing to read these things.
So that it's a substitute or a something where those of us who have these multiple challenges and problems and things that don't work out quickly, every now and then something works out. But with the mystery or a thriller, there's a resolution.
There is a resolution. So I've always wanted to write one. I thought it would be fun to do that. And so And I think, as I've said in other interviews, I'm something of a romantic. I kind of like taking on evil and good triumphing over evil. And so the thriller seemed to lend itself to human trafficking because there really is no greater evil. I mean, to be a trafficker, you have to have total disregard for other people and be very greedy. I mean, really pretty bad people. Mm-hmm. So I thought that would fit a thriller. And I also thought that people might read a thriller. People often read for pleasure, but also want to learn something. And I thought if I write a good thriller with a story that will capture the attention of the reader, they'll also learn about human trafficking in a fairly benign way. And then at the end of it, may want to know something more about it. So that's why I wrote Brutal Silence.
I mean, one of the questions I had, and you're on the verge of answering it, maybe you already have, is whether or not this book came out of your desire to inform the public about human trafficking or whether that just was something you could exploit to write a book that you wanted to write. Well, and is the main purpose of your book to entertain or is it to get us on our soapbox?
It's both. I think if you're going to write a book, it's a lot of work, way more than I expected when I sat down to start this. And you have to be passionate about your subject matter. And I was passionate about human trafficking and telling the story of that. But I also wanted to entertain and capture an audience to stay with the topic. And I think that was my motivation. So it's both.
You're doing just the opposite of what you said you loved about thrillers was that you could resolve the problem and then move on to the next one. And this one, you want to resolve the mystery of the book, but you want the reader to keep on going with his or her interest in the trafficking.
Yes, and when you get to the book, you'll see that my trafficker escapes, and he may be somewhere else. So the topic.
No, you've gotten us to the end of the book too early. But I'm going to follow your lead about that. Let's talk a little. Let's don't leave the human trafficking thing for good, but let's do go to the book. And since you started at the end. You broke the rules in terms of your own rules about having resolution in that you create a villain, you bring him to justice, and then he gets away.
Well, there are many villains in this book. And so there is resolution to Alex's story and everything she sets out to do in the book. But I wanted to make the point that human trafficking is going to go on, mm-hmm. even if for Alex, this story has some sort of an end.
Let's take a break and then come back and talk about the book.
Okay.
If you join us late, I'm visiting with Margaret Dartis, and we're talking about her book, Brutal Silence. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Margaret Dartis. She's the author of her debut novel, Brutal Silence. And if you join us late, this is set in the context of human the tragedy and the problem and challenge of that we face with human trafficking. And Margaret, your book is set in that context. Tell us what you will about the book.
Well, the book is physically set, the action of the book, in Dalton, North Carolina.
Sounds like Durham.
Which sounds like Durham. You guessed it.
It's a big southern town with a manufacturing base and But anyway, it's set
near the Kaw River.
it's set in this region of North Carolina.
In Dalton, which is a fictitious town that closely resembles mm-hmm. Durham. It's also set in Mexico City and in Tianjin, which is the human trafficking capital of the world.
Geographically, how close is that? Is the center of trafficking to Mexico City?
It's not far from Mexico City, maybe between 50 and 100 miles mm-hmm. south of Mexico City. And human traffickers operate there, live there. They live in mansions there. It's not a place I want to go particularly, but the internet is wonderful for writing. I looked it up on the internet and I found a video that the BBC had done of Tianjin. The narrator was with an activist driving through the town of Tianjin, commenting on what it looked like, showing photographs and showing the mansions of the traffickers. And so it was ready-made research.
Getting back to I keep wanting to call it Durham, getting back to your fictitious center of action in the United States in the North Carolina town. Tell us about the central character and what her work is in this town.
Well, Alex Harrington is a 25-year-old woman who runs a free clinic in Dalton, North Carolina. The book starts with every woman's worst nightmare. Alex is on vacation in Mexico City. She's on a public bus going out to see some ruins, and she's dragged from the bus by human traffickers.
So the traffickers just stop the bus and kidnap her, is it?
That's right. They're on the bus stops, and they drag her off the bus.
Is that a usual occurrence in down there?
Well, there are kidnappings in Mexico City. In Mexico generally, but there are kidnappings all around the world. One way that people are taken into trafficking is through kidnapping, though that's not as common as some of the other avenues.
And so who's kidnapping her?
So in this case, there are traffickers, and they drag her off the bus, and nobody on the bus tries to help her. The other passengers and the driver face forward on the bus. She's dragged off the bus and taken to a warehouse where she's unconscious. She wakes up looking into the faces of other women traffickers who have been been trafficked. Yes, Fortunately, Alex is a resourceful sort, and she's a champion runner. She manages to escape and return home to Dalton.
Now, tell us about. I mean, I don't want you to. This is in the early part of the book, but tell us how does she escape? I mean, these traffickers who are in the business of imprisoning people, they should, and you would expect them to be pretty efficient jail keepers. What?
Well, these particular traffickers are leave the women alone. They lock them in the warehouse and leave them alone for a short period of time. And Alex manages to find, with another woman, a weak place in the metal in the back of the warehouse and break through. And so she and this other woman run from the traffickers. They come back, see them, and chase them. But Alex manages to get away, whereas the other woman doesn't. She returns to Dalton.
Christina. Dies at this point, but then keeps popping up.
Alex's feeling of remorse that this woman was killed trying to escape with her follows her through the whole book, and it's the motivation for her wanting to know more about human trafficking and to take on human traffickers. She has a personal, not necessarily vendetta, personal drive to find out about human traffickers. When she goes back to Dalton, some months later, another woman seeks refuge in her free clinic, in Alex's free clinic, only to die soon thereafter. And Alex finds that human trafficking doesn't only happen in Mexico City. It's happening in her own hometown.
So this is her – I'm asked this as a question. This is her first notion that this is happening all around her?
Yes.
She thought, hey, I live in America and this great – town of Dalton or Durham, and there might be isolated instances of things like this, but this
I'm
not coming back here to deal with that. I'm leaving Mexico and hoping I never see this again.
And I think most people think trafficking is somewhere else. It's in Thailand or it's in Central Europe or maybe it's in Mexico, but certainly not in their hometown.
Or on the border of Burma and Bangladesh.
That's true. Yes, absolutely. And it's true. It is there. But it's also in the United States, and that's one of the points I wanted to make in the book. It's here, it's everywhere, and it's in your own hometown, including Chapel Hill.
Yeah, well, Chapel Hill and Durham, so you've, in the book, a key element of this really is that there's a sophisticated exploitation part of the business of putting these women into money-making prostitution is a money-making business in our area and participated in by some distinguished people, otherwise distinguished people.
That's right.
Now, do you believe that to be true?
Motivated by greed. Yes, I do. There are traffickers in all levels of society. It's big business. It's a $150 billion business annually.
In the U.S. or in the
worldwide?
Worldwide.
Worldwide.
And what would you estimate in this area that we're – I mean, are we just covered up with these people who are exploiting young women and squeezing money out of them and sending it to Mexico? Is that?
Well, it's hard to tell how many operations there are going on because the statistics in this area are understandably difficult. And traffickers don't self-report. They're not paying taxes. And unless you catch them, you don't know they're there necessarily.
Yeah.
But they are operating all over the world. And North Carolina is consistently in the top 10 states for human trafficking.
Well, you have as a part of your book a police, a law enforcement effort to find a missing woman and her protectors and to try to get to the bottom of this?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Well, the FBI is very active in human trafficking and local officials are active as well. I think we've made a lot of progress in the last few years.
You have a character, a local law enforcement official, a young African-American
yes,
woman who's
Keisha
attractive.
White.
Yeah, where did she – tell us about her.
Well, Keisha is one of my favorite characters. She's a former Olympic star who's become a police detective. And she helps Alex understand what's going on and also helps in her rescue.
Well, tell us what you – you tell as much about your story as you want to, but it gets more and more interesting. And what leads Alex to go back to Mexico, a place where she didn't really have a very happy experience?
Well, Alex finds that the traffickers are operating in her hometown, as I said. She is kidnapped by the traffickers, and she doesn't really know why they're kidnapping her. They're targeting her, and she wants to know why, and she also wants to find out who is behind this in her hometown. Again, she's driven by some remorse from Mexico City.
She's kidnapped again and escapes again?
Or? Yeah, she escapes again. I told you, she's very resourceful. She escapes with her housekeeper who is working in the clinic. And they're near the Haw River. I call it the Caw River. And they do manage to escape and come back. But then she has teamed up with a junior reporter.
This is Mike?
This is Mike.
And
Mike
wants... He's like a Durham Herald Sun reporter?
That's right, yeah. And he wants this is his big story. And he wants to go to Mexico to find out, to find the source of human trafficking. Alex has meanwhile, I don't want to give the whole story away, found reasons why there may be some money laundering connected with Mexico City. So she goes to Mexico with him because they are convinced that only in Mexico will they find the answer to who is trafficking in Durham.
Well, it's interesting. It was interesting to me. You set them up early on as being adversaries in a way. Here's a reporter.
Well, he's an annoying fellow.
Annoying fellow. And then all of a sudden she falls for him. So.
Well, he's annoying and he's aggressive. And, you know, a lot of young reporters are. If they're going to make their way, they have to be. But, you know, as they are in one adventure after the other, they get to, I think, like each other better.
What I'm going to take a break in just a minute and come back to the book. But I was interested, what kind of research did you have to do for the travel to Mexico City? You said you could do it by video to the kingpins.
To Chanasingo, yeah.
But what about Mexico City? Do you know that from your travels?
Or? No. I read travel magazines and also Fodor's Guide to Mexico City and things of that sort. Looked at pictures.
And... never tempted to go down there yourself and see?
No, I haven't been there. I've been all over the world, but I haven't actually been to Mexico City.
If you join us late, I'm visiting with Margaret Darness. We're talking about two things. One is her new book, well, a relatively new, her first book, her debut novel, Brutal Silence. And then we're talking about the real problems or the real challenges that we face with human trafficking. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Margaret Dardis and, you know, our neighbor here. And she's been very active in lots of community activities. And now bursting onto the scene as the debut novelist. But Margaret, even long before you published your book, you were active in the North Carolina Writers Network and now serving as the top dog, the president of that organization. I want you to talk a little bit, if you would, about your challenges as a first-time fiction writer of writing a book and some – was it – did it just work out? Did you just write it overnight? How did it happen?
Well, actually, I wrote it over 6 years. I was working full-time for most of that time.
What were you doing?
I was at UNC Healthcare in charge of communications and marketing at that point. But while I was writing it, I was working, as I said, full-time. So I had Saturdays and little pieces of time to write in. And that's a challenge, I think, for any author who's writing, is how to stay consistent and coherent in your approach to writing, because there's so many interruptions and other things you have to think about. Writing is also very lonely. When you're working, you have a camaraderie of people you're working with. When you're writing, you're by yourself at a desk or in a little office or in a coffee shop, and there's nobody to bounce ideas off. No one keep you going. It gets hard, and you think you hit a wall. You don't, you know, and you think, well, there's nobody out there waiting to read my book. Why am I doing this? Why don't I just go do something that's easier? But I'm a member of the North Carolina Writers Network, and I have been for a number of years. I love to read books, and I love hanging out with writers. And the Writers Network helped me tremendously because it's a network of writers across the state. The organization itself helps writers with various critiquing services. It connects them with each other. And we just had our fall conference in Wilmington last weekend where we have classes where writers come in and talk about things like character development, plot, and then we have keynote speakers, and you always come away from those. I always come away feeling energized and ready to go back to work. So it doesn't leave you all by yourself in a coffee shop struggling to persevere. So the Writers Network helped me tremendously through these 6 years.
Mainly by inspiring you, or were there techniques that you learned from your conversations with writers or from the talks that were given at the various meetings, including the seasonal conferences?
I learned techniques from the conferences. I definitely did. And then the best way to learn writing is to write. And so I would be writing along and hit a problem and think about what I had learned in some of the conferences. You know, often you can't really understand what they're talking about till you sit down to try to do it.
Well, talk if you will, about – I'm always curious about an author who, over a long period of time, in your case about 6 years, writes a book, whether – at what point you come up with your main characters, at what point you develop the skeleton of your plot, at what point you just kind of write along and hope that something will come together. How did you approach it, and how did you change your approach as time passed?
Well, Alex started out as a short.
This is your main,
yes,
main
my main character, Alex Harrington, is a short, blue-eyed blonde. She's now about 5'8", looks somewhat Hispanic, has very curly, dark hair, and almond-shaped eyes. So she changed quite a bit with the plot.
Did you start out with her, or did you start out with a situation or a plot? Or
I started with a situation, and I started with the clinic in Durham and the woman coming in who needed help, because I think that reminded me of the woman I had met at the conference. And then the story really told itself through the first third of the book.
How so?
Well, the characters just – I mean, I'd always heard that the characters take over and do their own thing, but they really did. You know, her one chapter just led to another chapter, and, you know, what seemed to be logical happened next, and where would this character likely to go?
So when you wrote the scene, which if people who were with us at the first part of this conversation will remember, you told us – What happened in Dalton, North Carolina, Durham, North Carolina, at a clinic that a woman who'd been trafficked came in.
Yes.
And that was your starting point.
That was my starting point, yes.
And then you backed up and took Alex to Mexico.
That's right. That came later because I felt she needed more of a personal connection with human trafficking. So I wrote the first chapter almost at the end of the book. And that's apparently not uncommon. When I've gone to writers' conferences like Thriller Fest in New York City, they'll say, stop worrying so much about your first chapter. What you're writing now is not going to be anything like what you end up with.
Well, do the people who give you advice about writing thrillers say that, hey, you better be disciplined. You better have an idea about what your ending is before you get started. Did you feel like you, even though you started out with a scene early on in the book, that you had a notion of where it might end?
I did. I knew where I wanted to end it. And then by the time I finished the first third of the book, I had a much clearer idea of where the rest of the book was going. So I outlined the rest of the book and spent a fair amount of time figuring out where it was going. And then the writing got easier.
The writer, once you know where you're going, the writing is
much
easier.
Much easier,
but you did, at the beginning, kind of let your characters tell you what the story
rather
than having the framework.
Right.
And that was harder. I'm this question mark. Was that harder than once you had your outline for the rest of the book?
Yes, it was. It was. But I can't do an outline until I have an overall idea of what's going
to. And you feel like you have to write a little bit in order to get
there. I do. But I think every writer is different. John Grisham writes 70-page outlines, you know, in infinite detail. I don't want to do that because I think I'd find it boring. If once I'd worked everything out, I'm not sure I'd have the discipline to sit there and write it. But it works for him. He sold the movie rights on one of his books from an outline, I understand.
Well, that all of us could be like that. But most folks who start out writing, and many people will be listening to our conversation and hearing your wisdom about it, will wonder how you got to the end of the project. And along the way, as you mentioned, most of the time you're working over there at UNC Healthcare.
That's
coming
right.
home and imagining this. You established a connection with two things that are critical to your book. One is the real trafficking. What's the trafficking situation? And the other is the geography of a strange place. How did you tackle the factual basis of trafficking so you could have real characters who would come out of that situation? How could you find out about that?
Well, I did a tremendous amount of research about trafficking.
And where do you go to do this research, or what are the sources for this?
I just
Google human trafficking.
You'll get a lot. Believe me, there are some websites that have quite a bit of information. Mm-hmm. The Polaris website, for example, will give a lot of background about human trafficking. But I had to figure out how to get into the minds of a trafficker, and that was really the hardest thing because I don't consciously know a lot of sociopaths. I don't hang out with them if I can avoid it, and I certainly don't know any Mexican crime bosses. So I studied a book called The Sociopath Next Door, fascinating book about sociopaths generally. And then I read the autobiography of El Sicario, who is a Mexican assassin. And then I read a lot of interviews with bad guys like El Chapo.
When I read the book, El Chapo's pocket face and background kept popping up.
Right. So
but he's drugs.
Right. And in the beginning of years ago with human trafficking was separate from drugs. The two groups didn't intermingle at all. Now it's so much money and such big business that the drug traffickers are also involved with human trafficking. The mindset of a sociopath and somebody who would take advantage of other people for greed, I think, is not
terribly
they're different.
They're similar. But this is new information, even beyond the context of your book, that instead of being a sort of separate crime syndicates, They're merging
mm-hmm.
together.
And the human trafficking used to be smaller operations and now is big business. And there are networks that move the victims of trafficking all around the world. The UN estimates that there are over 400 of these. Like the Underground Railway in the 19th century, these are
400
kind of
separate human trafficking organizations.
Networks around the world. Passages where they move the victims around.
Like the
through highways and on airplanes.
So that typically, where do the victims, that is the women who are kidnapped and put into service in prostitution, where do they come from?
All over the world, and from all socioeconomic levels, races. Anyone can be a victim, but the people who are the ones who are the most vulnerable are poor people, and particularly children.
I don't want to give away too much of your book, but one of the surprising things that happens to me is that some of the trustworthy law enforcement officials, local law enforcement officials, in your book are on the take to these, that they're being taken care of by these Mexicans or the networks to participate and cover up for this.
Yeah, there is one.
But
the rest are not.
But that's one is pretty. I mean, that makes it possible for them to operate.
That's right.
Like the moonshiners used to pay off the sheriffs.
That's
and all
right. That's
and
right.
Do you believe that's happening here?
Yes. I don't know that it's happening here in Durham or Chapel Hill, certainly, but I do know that there are. There is corruption.
Well, I want to ask you, why aren't there more? If this is so prevalent, why aren't there more prosecutions and more that we don't read more about people who are being caught and being tried and sent to prison?
Well, you do now. 10 years ago, we do have very good laws in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Against human trafficking. And now there are prosecutions under these laws. But it's hard to prosecute because you have to have the victims testify. You have to get them to testify, and they're afraid. So it's a difficult area of the law to actually enforce. Certainly, historically, there are other kidnapping, other areas that you can prosecute for that are probably easier than this. But there are arrests happening on a regular basis in Fayetteville. There have been some in Cary and Raleigh. Law enforcement in North Carolina is very diligent. I certainly don't want to imply that any of them are corrupt. I think they're dedicated to doing something about this problem.
The signal in your book is not that this is prevalent, but this is an exception, and there will
That's
be
right.
exceptions along
That's right.
the way. But basically, right. Our law enforcement officials, by and large, are ready to attack this.
I think they are.
Yes.
They yes.
All right. We're visiting with Margaret Dartness. We're talking about her debut novel, Brutal Silence, and we're talking about the human trafficking situation that is a part of that book. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Margaret Dartness. We're talking about her debut novel, Brutal Silence. It's a thriller and a page-turner. But surrounding all of it is the context of human trafficking, how really in her book, a Mexican crime king is the leader of an organization that kidnaps and imprisons and takes women and puts them into prostitution all over the world and even right around here. And so how would this Where would they go? Where would the human traffickers take their victims to perform the services that would provide the money to fund this enterprise?
Well, it can be in brothels or gentlemen's clubs or online or in just ordinary hotels.
How would you get them? How would that work? I mean, wouldn't it just be obvious that you'd have imprisoned women sort of being led in chains into the motel room and then...
Well, they probably aren't led in chains.
Uh-huh.
As I mentioned earlier, they become more or less victims of their fear of the traffickers themselves and seem to cooperate. Many people will ask, why don't they run away? And it's because of the psychological impact and also the fear and threats to their family and the like. But as I mentioned earlier, there are actual... roads or routes that women, children, and sometimes men are trafficked. So they're only in one place a very short period of time for the most part.
It's like a circus. They're moving from town to town?
That's right. They'll move them around. And there is, I have heard that there's a local hotel that is frequented by traffickers. And whenever the police, there's somebody there who tips the police off. When the police arrive, the traffickers are gone. So somebody's obviously tipping off the traffickers as well. But that's not uncommon. They're moving all the time. Sometimes they're only for a day or so.
You probably don't know this, but I'm just curious. How do they get their business if they're moving from place to place? If you've got a business, you need to advertise it. People need to know who to call, where to call, where to come. And so if you're running a prostitution business and you're trying to do it on a migrant basis, you'd have to have—
It's a tough business model.
Yeah, it's tough.
Well, the internet is a font of information. There are various ways to—and advertising and the like. Well, same way all businesses advertise,
well,
I guess.
Is there a—
And word of mouth.
If a potential customer of these services wants to take advantage, knows about this and wants to take advantage, you say he can go to the internet and find out
right.
where this is. And why couldn't the police posing as
well,
a
they do.
Consumer?
They do. But it takes a lot of resources to do sting operations.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI is monitoring cyber vehicles all the time, and they broke up they arrested somebody in Durham not long ago whom I knew, who had been trafficking two little boys. That was a big shock when I read that in the newspaper.
The other thing is that one of the deterrents to this would be the prosecution of consumers of the service, but you don't read too much about men who've been caught purchasing these services.
Right. If there weren't a demand, there wouldn't be a supply.
Yeah.
But that's a very difficult road. There are places where the law enforcement is attacking that as well.
Well, you got me all excited about this problem, and now we kind of reached a dead end about what the law enforcement options are. And I think your belief is that our law enforcement's doing what they can and doing it pretty well to attack this. But there's more to be done, and you're working on that angle as well, trying
That's
to inspire
right.
people
mm-hmm.
to do. I want more to talk about, but you've made it quite clear in writing the book, and anybody who gets to the end will know that you're coming up with a new book because you let one of the bad guys escape. So tell us about what you will about the next book that you're writing.
Well, the next book still involves Alex.
And
Alex Harrington is the lead character in Brutal Silence. And she's a young woman who lives in Dalton.
And is this evil, mean-spirited psychopath Vargas, is he going to play a role in the new book too?
Well, you'll have to read the book to find out.
Well, I know. he's the clue. Well, that's not fair.
But I can't imagine he's going to vanish altogether.
And once you've done this, how do you develop a new story? Do you just let that come to you, or do you have to do research to see how these things—
Again, it's a situation. I'm interested. I've been involved in not-for-profits for years, and I'm very disturbed by the fact that some of them are not legitimate, or that there's corruption in some of them, certainly not all of them.
What do you mean by corruption?
Or there'll be misappropriation of funds. There are various scandals that have broken over the last few years. And that discourages people from donating money because they don't trust the organizations that they're giving money to. So I was interested in that. Alex goes to work. She leaves Dalton because it's a bad memory for her. She goes to New York City and is hired by an international relief organization and sent right back to Mexico because she knows Spanish and she knows something about Mexico. And she's working for earthquake in mm-hmm. southeastern mm-hmm. Mexico mm-hmm. where there mm-hmm. was an earthquake 3 years before. And then the book starts with another earthquake. And her new closest friend is killed in that earthquake. And it shouldn't have happened because it wasn't a really severe earthquake, but the new buildings are falling down.
Mm.
And these are the buildings that were supposed to have been built to code. So there's something going on here. There's some level of corruption. And she sets out to find out why her best friend had to die in this earthquake. The ironic thing is that where this earthquake takes place in the novel is exactly where the earthquakes took place last summer.
My golly. So you identified it in advance.
I did. No one's going to think I'm creative at all.
Well, listen, we're looking forward to having the chance to visit with you about that new book when you finish it. In the meantime, thanks so much for taking time to tell us both about your new book or your debut novel and about the trafficking situation that underpins it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks to my guest has been Margaret Darness. Thanks to her, and thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking WCHL 97.9 The Hill. I'll be back here before you know it.